me, Colin.
Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Friday, June 26, 2020. The numbers keep climbing, sometimes doubling, related to the spread of the coronavirus. And we'll have an update. The bars are going to be closed in Florida and Texas this weekend. But the big news today revolves around Trump's attorney general and the guy who plays his personal attorney using the Justice Department to defend Trump and his cronies, and that would be William Barr. And Bill Barr is the subject of quite a few reports today. First, in a front-page story at the New York Times, they dug into his involvement, and some would call it interference, in the affairs of the generally independent prosecutor's office in New York, the Southern District U.S. Attorney's Office. And as you know, it was just a week ago, after we had all gone to the bars on Friday night, that Barr announced that Jeffrey Berman was stepping down, followed by Jeffrey Berman's announcement, not so fast. And then Barr arranged to have the U.S. attorney, Jeffrey Berman, fired by the president on Saturday. So that is one of the most overt cases of the direct intervention or interference by Barr in the New York U.S. attorney's office. And the New York Times, citing a number of sources, indicates that shortly after he was confirmed, which was in February of 2019, as Attorney General, Barr began probing the affairs of the New York office. First, in the case of Michael Cohen, who had already been convicted, that's Trump's lawyer. But Barr was trying to figure out whether the conviction of Mike Cohen, which was based on illegal campaign contributions in the form of the hush money that was paid to Stormy Daniels and the Playboy Playmate, whose name I forget. The Playmate, McDougal was her name. She was paid by the National Enquirer, and then Trump failed to pay the rag back. So these issues were left outstanding. Michael Cohen fell on his sword, but Trump's CFO, the guy who wrote the checks for the hush money, and then the checks that were used to pay back Cohen for the advance that he made to pay off Trump's alleged mistress? Well, what Barr did apparently succeed in doing was limiting the damage to Mike Cohen. And so the Times has done a good job of exposing this. And Berman himself, the guy who was fired last weekend, had been recused from the Cohen case, but for undisclosed reasons. And I've always believed that the Cohen case is the strongest criminal behavior attributed to the president. But unlike in the Nixon impeachment, where Nixon was named an unindicted co-conspirator, Trump escaped that. And it could have been the intervention of Bill Barr that achieved that. So the other report about Barr is that the Senate Judiciary Committee, helmed by administration toady Lindsey Graham, in a 21-to-1 vote, that is stunning these days, approved a measure to strengthen the role of the Justice Department's independent watchdog. That's the Inspector General. Now, we've seen a wave of inspectors general fired by Trump, most notably at the State Department. We'll get to that one in a moment. But this is a pretty interesting move. When the Republicans who refused to do their duty to investigate the impeachment charges, to call for new witnesses, to listen to John Bolton, to get the documents that the White House stonewalled, they're now saying that this Justice Department can't be trusted. And here is a statement from Mike Lee, hardline right-winger, senator from Utah. The negative ramifications of shielding attorney misconduct from inspector general scrutiny and eventually public scrutiny are not hypothetical. This is a problem that Congress should want to fix. And Barr worked behind the scenes with Graham to try to water this down. He had some people lobby certain senators, arguing that no bill should allow the inspector general to supersede his existing powers and that the attorney general must be fully responsible for all investigations and indictments, namely, above the law and above any kind of oversight or investigation. So this is the second time in a week that Lindsey Graham has stood up and shown some spine. This is a remarkable development. And it could be that the Republicans who closed ranks to keep Trump from being removed under the impeachment process have decided that they need a little distance from this guy. He's toxic. Graham has a tough election ahead in November. So this is an interesting fissure that has surfaced. Now, I want to note that I appear to be the only one in my orbit who has reported, based on an email I got from the friends of Jeffrey Berman on Monday, that Jay Clayton, who was supposed to parachute in and become the acting U.S. attorney in Southern District of New York pending Senate confirmation, that he is the subject of an SEC whistleblower. Clayton is currently the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. And as I reported, and this is undocumented, or, you know, I don't have a substantiation from a second source, but the friends of Jeffrey said that the whistleblower surfaced a few weeks back, alleging a cover-up at the SEC of investigations into fraud related to the Puerto Rico bonds. I haven't seen it in the Times. I haven't seen it in the Post. I haven't heard it mentioned in the television news programs that I survey every night. But Clayton himself was up on the Hill yesterday in a separate testimony related to his current job at the SEC. And he tried to dodge questions about being appointed as the U.S. attorney in New York, saying that, in short, I am fully committed to and focused on my role at the SEC. But my old pal Brad Sherman is the congressman from Sherman Oaks in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles. He opened the subcommittee hearing by saying that Clayton should resign, that he should withdraw his name from nomination. And this was after Graham, this is the other showing of spine, indicated that he would return to the longstanding practice of allowing the senators from a state to approve the nomination of a U.S. attorney. Mitch McConnell has bulldozed that in many cases to install his right-wing crew. But this was where Lindsey Graham drew a line. So Clayton, of course, is not willing to step down at the SEC or to withdraw his nomination as U.S. attorney, but the knives are out. I think that is fair to say. And Bill Barr, who, in order to dodge a subpoena from the House Judiciary Committee, suddenly made himself available for an appearance in late July, he went on NPR today to play his aw shucks character, and he's really good at this. Maybe you've seen him in the confirmation hearing or some of the other testimony that he's given. He talks in this low voice like a victim, and he's just perplexed about why he is so controversial. He blames conspiracy theorists. He says there is no such pattern of his advancing President Trump's personal interests. I would say that that is a media narrative that has been adhered to, where things that happen all the time in the Department of Justice are misrepresented to the public and cast as somehow suspicious. And I credit the Washington Post under the byline of Aaron Blake because they took that comment and they ripped it to shreds. Because they cite, as I just did, the firing of Jeffrey Berman in New York, and then the whole litany of ways in which Barr has operated outside the precedence of an attorney general. To give a misleading preview of the Mueller report, to intervene in the Roger Stone sentencing that was aired out this week, to intervene in the Mike Flynn case that was the subject of a bizarre appeals court ruling this week. And as you know, I don't oppose his investigation into the origins of the Russiagate investigation. I just don't believe that it's going to be fair or unbiased. And so this is quite a list of charges against a sitting attorney general. And if we weren't so close to the election, and if Democrats hadn't been burned by their last attempt to impeach Trump, I think there would be quite an appetite to impeach Mr. Barr. So I referenced the Inspector General at the State Department. And as you know, Mike Pompeo got Trump to fire the IG just a few weeks ago. Part of the reason was that the Inspector General was taking a look at a move by Pompeo to approve arms sales to Saudi Arabia that had been held up under a long-standing practice by members of Congress who objected. And now at the White House, senior Trump administration officials are discussing whether to end the process for congressional review that has allowed lawmakers from either party to block weapons sales to foreign governments over humanitarian concerns. If adopted, the change would effectively end congressional oversight of the sale of American weapons and offers of training to countries engaged in wars with high civilian casualties or human rights abuses. In this case, it's the war in Yemen. And Senator Bob Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, and a man who is carrying his own corrupt baggage, nevertheless tried to block the sale of about $500 million worth of precision-guided bombs to Saudi Arabia. And that was the move that was ignored by the Secretary, Mike Pompeo, and the sale went through. So this is just another effort not only to eliminate the inspectors general, but to enhance power at the White House at the expense of the legislative branch. And the latest salvo to kill Obamacare was delivered just before midnight, the deadline, last night, as the Trump administration filed briefs at the Supreme Court, an 82-page document joining Republican officials in Texas and 17 other states. And what they are saying is that the Republican-controlled Congress in 2017, as part of the tax cut package that was rammed through at the end of the year, eliminated the tax penalty for the individual mandate. So if you don't buy insurance, you don't have to pay a fine. And because that fine or that payment was considered a tax and not a fee by Chief Justice John Roberts when he upheld the constitutionality of Obamacare, they are now arguing that when they removed that fee, it causes the legal underpinnings of Obamacare to collapse, and that the court should kill it, put it out of its misery. And so outgoing Solicitor General Noel Francisco argued that the health law's two remaining central provisions are now invalid because Congress intended that they work together with the individual mandate. And that was really a way to try to goad people into a full coverage situation, which would make the numbers work for the actuaries who figure out the price of health care insurance. So this, of course, as we mentioned the other day, is pretty bad optics at a pretty tough time for many Americans who have lost their employer health insurance coverage because they lost their jobs. And it's not coming back anytime soon, at least certainly not before November. And so as many as 23 million Americans rely on Obamacare now to get their insurance coverage. Many of them get subsidies to reduce the incredible cost. And the Democrats introduced legislation in the House today. We discussed this a couple of days ago, the Pelosi strategy to expand some of those subsidies to make the Affordable Care Act a little more affordable. It's not really affordable to most working families, but we'll put that semantic discussion aside. So this is a risky move. This is Trump following through on one of his campaign pledges or threats, if you want to call it that. But it puts a lot of Republicans in a dicey situation because any Republican who voted for the tax cut bill at the end of 2017 voted to undermine Obamacare, and that is the legal premise being used to try to put it out of its misery now. And this will put a lot of those Republicans at risk for Democratic or super PAC ads that can blame them for the repeal of Obamacare without replacing it. And this will all happen before the Supreme Court can possibly take up the case. But it should be a pretty damaging line of attack. So Jack Abramoff is getting ready to pack his bags for another tour in a federal prison. Do you remember Jack? He was the Uber lobbyist in Washington under the Bush administration who made K Street hum. He fleeced Native American gaming operations. He was part of the diabolical effort to put Don Siegelman in federal prison, the former Democratic governor of Alabama. He ran a corrupt cruise ship line that got him into trouble. He had a fancy restaurant in Washington where he gave free meals and expensive wine to his Republican friends. And as some of you may recall, I got an interview with Jack Abramoff in the fall of 2011. We posted it on December 19th of that year. And he is the only guest I've had on this podcast who hung up on me in the middle of the interview. And Abramoff did that because I ambushed him by bringing on Tom Rogers, an activist from the Blackfoot Nation, who had helped expose Abramoff's double dealing with Indian tribes that went back to 2003. I think you'll find it a great interview. I've thrown up a link in the show file to the podcast, so if you've got time, click on it, and you can hear what Abramoff had to say. It was his apology tour. He'd published a book, and he was all contrite, never going to do it again. And now he has taken a guilty plea to conspiracy and violating the Lobbying Disclosure Act, facing as much as another 5 years in prison. This is part of a Bitcoin scam that he and who's the other guy here? Roland Marcus Andrade is the founder of a company called AML Bitcoin. Jack Abramoff was out there hustling investors, raised at least $5.5 million from 2,400 different people, and he's now headed back behind bars. I won't be shedding a tear for Jack, I'll tell you that. So we nominally have an agency in Washington that is supposed to be the referee of campaign finance laws and election rules. It's called the Federal Elections Commission. And you don't hear much about it because it has been totally defanged. The reason is that both parties play games with the appointment of commissioners. And it was just a little over a month ago that the agency finally had enough members that it could conduct business. That's called a quorum. And now it has lost its quorum because Caroline Hunter, a long-serving Republican appointee on the FEC, announced her resignation not to spend more time with her family, but to go to work with a Koch lobbying group. So, without Hunter, the six-member panel is once again left with only three commissioners, which makes it impossible for them to meet, to review complaints, to issue rulings, to issue fines to people who violate the rules. So it means there is no sheriff in place for the November elections. And while the Democrats will whine louder than the Republicans, it serves the interests of both parties. And I didn't realize this, but Trump's appointee, a guy from Texas named James E. Trey Traynor, he's got a horrible record of voter suppression and similar tactics that have been part of the Republican playbook. And because of the revolving door over there, he is now the chair of the Federal Elections Commission. He's only been there a month. And, for example, Ellen Weintraub, the lone Democrat on the panel, was appointed for a six-year term that expired in 2007. And 13 years later, she is still there. Likewise, Stephen Walther, an independent, his last term expired in 2009. So he's been held over for 11 years. That shows you that this is an intentionally ineffective agency. Well, some good news from Capitol Hill. The democratically controlled House voted to designate the District of Columbia as the 51st state. And the way it would work, there would remain a District of Columbia, but it would be shrunk to a 2-square-mile radius that includes the White House, the Capitol, the monuments, most of the federal buildings, the Smithsonian, that's one of my favorites. And it would create a new entity that would be called Washington, Douglas Commonwealth. So the letters would remain the same. It would be Washington, D.C., but instead of District of Columbia, the D and the C would stand for Frederick Douglass and the word Commonwealth. And this, of course, draws negative comments from Republicans, one of whom suggested Andy Harris, Republican of Maryland, who said, well, you know, the District of Columbia was carved out of territory that was part of the state of Maryland. So why not just allow the district to be re-annexed to the state of Maryland? But Maryland doesn't want that, and the people in the district don't want that. The real issue on the political level is that a new state would have two senators, and those two senators would likely be Democrats. There'd also be one member of the House of Representatives who would likely be a Democrat as well. As you know, here at the Peter B. Collins podcast, we have raised money from our listeners and a little money from yours truly to fund our community fund. And we are doling out $100 grants to people who send me an email and make a case that they could use an extra $100 right now. And yesterday, as I told you, a guy named Tony made a request that I thought was frivolous, and he is the only one whose grant request has been turned down to date. And earlier this week, I agreed to a $100 grant to Jonah Leto. And Jonah is a high school graduate in the Seattle area. He is going on to college at the University of Minnesota, where he plans to major in journalism. And so I have asked him to become our correspondent in Seattle. And today he filed his first report on CHOP, that's the Capitol Hill protest zone. And he said, as we have covered earlier this week, the mayor, Jenny Durkin, and the police chief are making noises that it's time to wrap. It was called Chaz, too. And Jonah reports tensions are high after some bulldozers were moved near the barriers that designate the boundaries of CHOP. This led to shouting, "Red alert! CHOP can't sleep!" Some protesters laid down in front of the dozers. Police were stationed a block away to protect the Seattle Department of Transportation. People in the CHOP are naturally concerned and are more on edge than usual. There's been quite a bit of mainstream media around. They seem to only turn on their cameras if they can find a conflict. The CHOP chief of security was heard advising protesters to be aware that media are trying to capture unfavorable optics. And although the media like to claim that the protesters' demands are unclear, those demands are spray-painted everywhere, and they're in front of the CHOP barrier at 12th and Pike Streets. Protesters want a 50% budget cut. Police have responded with a 100% service cut, including ambulances, and a work slowdown to the entire neighborhood with up to 15-minute response to that area being reported by the police themselves. The second demand is to help fund black communities and restorative justice, housing, and health care. These are services only the people of the CHOP are attempting to provide through mutual aid. The third demand is freedom for all arrested protesters, and this demand has not been responded to. There are some negotiations underway. And finally, he reports, in the middle of the streets of CHOP, there are porta-potties for people to use. Even though these porta-potties are in the middle of the road, they may use bulldozers to clear out people and barriers, but they seem unlikely to be used on the portable toilets. A bulldozer can only push things aside, and it remains to be seen if the protesters' demands will be pushed to the side or treated seriously. Thank you, Jonah, for that report. Interesting, because today in the New York Times, they are reporting on behind-the-scenes lobbying that led to the very weak Senate bill that was authored by Senator Tim Scott, the only African-American Republican in the U.S. Senate today. And we see the fine hand of the police lobby, the lobbyist for the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, Larry Cosme, who, according to the New York Times, was at a meeting with Republican leaders, including the embattled Attorney General Bill Barr. And Cosme first talked to Barr, who told him not to worry because the legislation from the Senate will never go as far as that being written in the House, which in itself is not as strong as it could be. So, the Times writes, indeed, the bill that Mr. Scott introduced the next day fell well. On Wednesday, it stalled in the Senate as Democrats called it a woefully inadequate response. So Larry Cosme is the successor to a guy named Tom Scotto. And it was the Washington Post that a few weeks back reported that when Joe Biden was authoring his nefarious crime bill, which included enhancement of the death penalty, the crack cocaine differential, a federal three strikes clause, that all that was written by Tom Scotto, who was at that time the head of the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association. And Tom Scotto bragged that Joe Biden took everything he wrote verbatim. He didn't change a thing. An excellent report I want to recommend it to you from The Intercept today, under the bylines of Mara Vistendahl and Aline Brown. And through leaks that came to their attention from a murky group called Blue Leaks, published on the website Distributed Denial of Secrets, well, they got a bunch of documents from law enforcement related to the efforts to quell the street protests in Minneapolis. Just a few weeks ago. So, presuming that these documents are accurate and based on the quotes from The Intercept, they are quite credible, they reveal a kind of hysteria that was coming from the apparatus created after 9/11 that we were told would only be used to protect us from dangerous international terrorist attacks. And so the Minnesota Fusion Center, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, they were making coffee 24/7 and firing off reports, including those that went to the Minneapolis Police Department. And a lot of the information wasn't accurate. It was exaggerated. A May 29th briefing from the Joint Regional Intelligence Center in the L.A. area, for example, said that protesters might use black bloc tactics involving collective, frequently violent action. And a May 30th update from the Multi-Agency Command Center, that's in Minnesota, it was created just for these episodes. They say unconfirmed reports of the possibility of affluent neighborhoods in areas outside of the immediate metro being targeted. Unconfirmed reports of extremist group activity in Minnesota related to civil unrest. And the reporters say the anxiety that pervades the leaked documents from Minneapolis seemed to be reflected in the extreme police reaction throughout the days that followed. Because they were getting this information that they thought was legitimate about violent protesters driving in from other areas, about collusion with Antifa units and the Hell's Angels. The documents make it clear that in some cases, law enforcement had visibility into private communications and social media. They were able to hack Slack. I don't know if you've used that platform, but it's a way that people connect. A June 6th report contended that a revolutionary anti-capitalist group in Minneapolis had collected details on law enforcement's whereabouts. They used the Slack messaging app to pass intelligence to the Antifa portion of the group. Only, we don't have any evidence so far that there was an Antifa contingent on the streets of Minneapolis. It's been suspected, but no one has offered any evidence so far, and there have been no arrests of people accused of being part of Antifa. Some of the reports refer to an unnamed federal partner, likely the FBI, using labels like black separatist, black racially motivated violent extremist, black identity extremists. Yet, no major black activist group has proven to be a significant violent threat to the public in the United States. A May 30th document suggests that the 4th Precinct in Minneapolis could be the target for violence, apparently based on a social media post by a leader of the General Defense Council, which the document refers to as a branch of Antifa. But Antifa ain't got no branches. A June 1st report from the same outfit, the Multi-Agency Command Center. Antifa will utilize vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices to launch attacks against National Guard and law enforcement agencies. The vehicles will bear fictitious license plates. But there's no evidence of anything of the sort surfacing in Minneapolis at that time. A June 4th bulletin from the Sheriff's Office noted that the members of the Buhajideen, a term affiliated with the Boogaloo movement, had been spotted claiming to protect historically black neighborhoods in North Minneapolis. And another report said that the Hell's Angels had brought approximately 75 Aryan cowboys from northern Minnesota to Minneapolis for protection, and that some of them would pose as Antifa members. So it appears that a lot of fiction was generated, disseminated, and may have led to the violent police behavior, the brutal put-down of protesters, most of whom were unarmed. And it's impossible for me to judge this, but it occurs to me that it's possible that many of the episodes of looting, vandalism, torching of buildings, destruction of businesses and vehicles may have actually been sparked by the overreaction of the police. I'd love to see that investigated. And not directly related to what I just shared with you, but I think relevant to it, is an op-ed at The Guardian today by Mike German, the former FBI officer. He was a guest on this podcast within the last 6 months or so. He's at the Brennan Center at NYU now. And he writes about the history of the FBI's bias toward black Americans, going back to 1919, the early days of J. Edgar Hoover, Hoover's COINTEL program in the 1960s that also bled over into the 70s. And he says that the reforms after COINTELPRO were weakened over time, most severely in 2008, by the Bush administration Attorney General Michael Mukasey. Mukasey was on Capitol Hill this week defending Bill Barr. Everything's normal. Mukasey's guidelines authorized a new type of investigation called an assessment, which required no factual basis for suspecting individualized wrongdoing before agents could employ intrusive investigative techniques like interviews, surveillance, commercial database searches, and informants. The FBI interpreted these guidelines to allow its agents to use census data to map American communities by race, to identify and monitor ethnic facilities and behaviors. So, German writes, it wasn't surprising when a new generation of political activists started the Black Lives Matter movement after the 2014 incidents in Ferguson, Missouri. By 2017, German says, the FBI had invented a new domestic terrorism program category called the Black Identity Extremism Movement. An FBI intelligence report cited 6 unrelated incidents over a 3-year period in which black subjects not associated with one another attacked police officers to allege that a movement driven by perceptions of police brutality existed. So this is a significant indictment of the FBI. And as I pointed out yesterday in my comments about the framing of so-called Muslim American domestic terrorist suspects using those paid informants, we see that the FBI is getting a pass. No discussion of reframing its role, cutting its budget. No, they have special status. And this one surprised me. It's at The Guardian today, and I once again have to say that for a British-based, online-only media outlet, they do some incredible enterprise reporting in the United States. I had never heard of Wildlife Services. It is a unit of the Department of Agriculture, and it apparently has carte blanche to travel the country and to kill suspected predatory animals without any interaction or coordination with local authorities. And the Guardian article talks about a case from Pocatello, Idaho in 2017, where one of their cyanide bombs that was aimed to blow up some kind of predatory animal, maybe a coyote, it detonated and killed a dog and poisoned a child who survived. And the family is still, very angry about this. Teresa Mansfield is the mother of the child who was injured. And Peter DeFazio, a pretty good guy, a Democrat congressman from Oregon, a longtime critic of Wildlife Services, said that the agency is more secretive than Homeland Security. He said, and I served on the Homeland Security Committee for 10 years. Wildlife Services is more opaque than some of our intelligence agencies. Basically, in some cases, it is rogue. And he said that the operation in Idaho basically runs itself with little transparency or accountability to anybody in Washington. We have another warning about election hacking attributed to Russians. This one comes from Symantec, the web security firm, and it has reported to the Treasury Department that we should expect a wave of ransomware attacks. And this is where hackers get into your computer system and they lock it down, deny you access to it until you pay them off. And late last year, a cyber attack on a Louisiana internet services company allowed hackers to target the Louisiana Secretary of State just weeks before an election. In Tillamook County, Oregon, in January, ransomware attackers prevented voter registration personnel from accessing voter data as they readied for the May primaries. Now, Symantec says 31 entities, including major American brands and Fortune 500 firms, have been attacked. And the hackers leave messages and sign it Evil Corp, which is a playoff from the Mr. Robot TV series. And the FBI assesses that these ransomware attacks are coming from Russia. But they take pains to say it's not necessarily state actors at the FSB or other intelligence units of the Russian government. Here's today's COVID-19 update, edited by Linda Lewis. The worldwide count so far is nearly 10 million cases, 9.6 million, and nearly 500,000 deaths. It's at 491,000. In the United States, we are approaching 2.5 million cases and 125,000 deaths. And there is a real surge in almost everywhere except the New York region and parts of New England, who were in the throes of the earliest hotspots of the coronavirus. But in the South, Midwest, and West Coast, we're seeing numbers jump. Half of the country, 26 states, have seen their caseloads increase in the past week. Arizona up 77%. Michigan, that was an early hotspot, but they're getting a new round. I won't call it a second wave because I don't think we've completed the first wave. 75% increase in Michigan, 70% in Texas, 66% in Florida. And it was first the governor of Texas who announced that he's closing the bars. He didn't want to do it, but he's decided those are high-risk environments. And as we'll check in a moment, Florida has reluctantly decided to close its bars this weekend. Seven states, including Arizona, have set records for the number of people hospitalized, and the percentage of all tests that come back positive is also increasing. So the whole point of the national lockdown was to buy time to improve testing, to give infection levels a chance to drop, and to make sure we didn't overwhelm hospitals. Well, that was successful in New York with a significant body count. But as other parts of the country have reopened, and it's clear some of that was premature, we're seeing these big spikes. So Florida reports its biggest single-day increase, 9,000 coronavirus cases from yesterday. That brings their total to about 123,000. So one of the accusations leveled against the state of Florida and its Republican governor, Ron DeSantis, is that they have been cooking the books to keep the numbers low. And, of course, that's Trump's strategy. Don't test, and we don't have to deal with the cases because we don't know about them. So Ron DeSantis, as you know, fired a woman named Rebecca Jones. And she was running a website with a dashboard that had all of the COVID-19 data updated every day. But Jones, who says she was fired for refusing to manipulate the figures, claimed on social media to have evidence that employees at Florida's Department of Health have been instructed this week to change the numbers and begin slowly deleting deaths and cases, so it looks like Florida is improving next week in the lead up to July 4th. To make it look like they've made it over the hump. So she says they're only reporting all these cases now so they can restrict reporting next week. She notes that they do not include people from out of state who die in Florida in their death statistics and suggests that other games are being played. There's also a battle in Florida over masks. The governor is refusing a statewide mandate. But in Miami, the mayor, Francis Suarez, is proposing a $250 fine for people refusing. And even Marco Rubio, who I don't consider to be the brightest bulb in the chandelier, says everyone should just wear a damn mask. So that is the struggle that's going on there. We're also seeing an interesting shift in the demographics of those infected, but so far not those who are fatally infected. And that is that people in their 20s and 30s are showing up as a big percentage of those who are testing positive. So more than 1.77 million people in Florida have been tested so far, and the median age of new cases is about 35. The 20 to 40-year-olds appear to be spreading the infection unperceived. They are just as easily infected as the elderly, but much more likely to show no or mild symptoms. People in these age groups are the ones who have allowed the virus to smolder through our communities and erupt into flames when they make contact with a susceptible population. And unlike older people like me, when we look at the 18 to 49-year-olds, we see that the number of positive cases has remained more or less constant throughout this pandemic. We're now seeing that more than 60% of all infections in the U.S. are occurring in people under the age of 50. And in Japan, a recent contact tracing study demonstrated how significant the 20 to 40-year-olds are in the initiation of new clusters. About 50% of all clusters traced were initiated by this age group. A significant revelation from the research was that the majority of 20 to 40-year-old index cases were showing no disease symptoms at the time of contact with the people they infected. You may remember back in March that Mike Pence, the vice president, was first put in charge of the coronavirus task force. And then Trump elbowed him aside and took control of those meetings and stayed on TV for 2 or 3 hours a night. Well, Trump is finished with COVID, so Pence is back. And he's offering soothing blue sky comments about how great a job that they've done and how, you know, he's not going to force people to wear masks, but you should listen to your state and local authorities. He says freedom of speech, the right to peacefully assemble, is enshrined in the Constitution. And so he, you know, is trying to spin up the prospect of additional shutdowns. We have states that have paused their reopenings because of the rising numbers of new cases. Pence said that hospital capacity remains strong and very, very broadly available. Of course, that's selective commentary because we know that in Texas, particularly around Houston, we know that in Alabama, there are very few vacancies in intensive care units and hospital beds in general. And the number of vacancies is declining in Florida. Pence also, and this is something that Trump doesn't even attempt, he encouraged Americans to take comfort in the fact that fatalities are declining. And that part is true. He also spun up the new caseload, saying, the reality is we're in a much better place than we were 2 months ago. So he is, conducting this kind of fanciful spin operation. And he told governors on a conference call the other day, I think they were all Republicans, that we need to accentuate the positive as this spins out of control and Trump is preoccupied with his Twitter toy. And Anthony Fauci appeared at the White House for the first time in a while today, and he described a paradigm shift. We're dealing with young people who are going to be asymptomatic, people who are getting infected in a community setting, not an outbreak setting, where you know who to identify, isolate, and contact trace. Fauci has some other comments we'll get to in a moment, but first, I wanted to share with you, I asked Linda Lewis to do a little research on any correlation that has been shown between the George Floyd Black Lives Matter protests and the uptick in positive tests for COVID. And she found a study from the University of Colorado, Denver. A working paper released today found that Black Lives Matter protests did not lead to an increase in COVID-19 cases. Using anonymous cell phone tracking data, as well as data on the local prevalence of COVID-19 from the CDC, The researchers found while social distancing between protesters may have decreased, the general population saw an increase in social distancing behaviors during that time period. The study shows that the impact of protests on COVID-19 was not driven solely by the protest attendees. The overall impact on the population depends on the behavior of the overall population, some of which increased social distancing. So this is interesting because as I watched the protests just a few weeks back, I was concerned that these people in fighting racism and standing up for their rights were dangerously exposing themselves to infection. And it appears that I was wrong, and I'm glad I was. So Dr. Fauci confirmed today that there are discussions about trying to speed up the testing process by using what is called pool testing. And the way this would work is that, say, you have samples of 20 people. You put them into a single pool. And if the entire pool comes back negative, then you don't have to test each individual. And so if you look at testing 100 people in batches of 20, and there is one positive test, you end up conducting a total of 25 tests instead of 100 tests. So that could allow the process to speed up, and I think it is an interesting proposal. We will see if it passes muster with the scientific community and if it can be implemented quickly. The Latino community is seeing a spike that is disproportionate to its population numbers. Coronavirus infections among Latinos have far outpaced those among the rest of the population during the recent surge. In the past 2 weeks, counties across the country, where at least a quarter of the population is Latino, have recorded an increase of 32% in new cases compared with 15% for all other counties. The analysis affirms broad national tallies by the CDC, and Latinos are making up 34% of nationwide cases, nearly double their representation in the population. I want to thank Andrea Hegland, who is up in Washington State. And as we have shared with you, she is an advocate for the use of hydroxychloroquine in a cocktail with other drugs to treat the coronavirus in its early stages. And today she sent me an academic paper from France. And I want to be clear that this will not affect your view of hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for COVID, but it relates to the profit motive and the fact that in France, for example, the committees that have been set up to review possible treatments and a potential virus are dominated by people with huge links to the pharmaceutical industries, and in particular to Gilead Sciences. And I know Gilead. They developed the hepatitis C drug that cost $60,000 for a course, and they are huge profiteers from the medications that they develop. And although the United States government invested some $71 million in Gilead's development of remdesivir, Gilead holds the patent. And the projections, which are only estimates at this point, on how much they will charge for a course of treatment are extremely high. And when you compare that to hydroxychloroquine, which has been trashed in government studies in the United States and in Europe, the profit motive is not included in those calculations. And so hydroxychloroquine is essentially available for pennies per pill compared to the projected $4,500 minimum per treatment of remdesivir if it is approved for use on coronavirus patients. And it has been tested with what I view as mixed results. So If I can, I think I can import this and put up a link to it. But I think it is an interesting study. I remain open-minded that if we can establish that hydroxychloroquine is effective, that it should be deployed. And I've admitted that my bias is that Trump has promoted it, and that has led me to be extremely skeptical. We have a report of a second toddler in a single county in Tennessee dying of COVID-19. This is in Tennessee, the county of Hamilton. I don't know what city is nearby, but we don't have any name or too many details. But a toddler, she's described as, has died of coronavirus. And there was a child under the age of 5 who similarly died from COVID back in April. And neither patient, both are described as Latino, and neither had any other compromising health conditions. I want to commend the New York Times, a strong editorial today condemning the treatment of prisoners in federal lockups, the failure to respond to the clear warnings that these would become laboratories, petri dishes for the spread of the virus. There have been at least 627 virus-related deaths in prisons across the United States, not just the federal system. And the testing of inmates lags, even in states like New York. In Mississippi, Alabama, and Illinois, fewer than 2.5% of state prison inmates have been tested. The Bureau of Prisons first told hundreds of its inmates that they were going to be serving the rest of their sentences at home. And then without explanation, they just rescinded that back in April, and those inmates are still locked up. So this is a huge failure. And we can't call it accidental. The idea that prisoners are disposable entities pervades the thinking of many political leaders. Scientists are collecting data on the cleaner air that we have been enjoying, the lack of pollution because of the worldwide lockdown due to the pandemic. In India, which has featured some of the most polluted skies in the world, New Delhi has had blue skies, and scientists are collecting data on air quality. They're trying to learn what some of the biggest triggers are, and because more people are now working at home and that trend is likely to continue, they're hoping that commuter traffic will decline. One of the curious developments, though, is that cleaner air has led to a spike in ozone. And they quote Michael Benjamin at the Atmospheric Monitoring Laboratory here in California. He said that this could have surprising implications for our state, which has led the nation in implementing tough clean air policies. So it's something they're exploring. I can't give you a definitive statement of what the shift in ozone levels actually is. Facebook has blinked in the face of a massive advertiser boycott now involving more than 100 brands. Mark Zuckerberg issued a live video today, and he has said that after Facebook's stock dropped 7%, he is going to copy Twitter and label posts that may violate its policies, but they will be allowed to remain on the platform because they are deemed newsworthy. So they're also going to include a link to its voting information center on any post that includes information about voting, including statements by politicians, and that any post that may lead to violence or deprive people of their right to vote will be removed regardless of who posts them or whether they may be considered newsworthy. With a couple of exceptions, I've allowed the speculation about who Joe Biden will choose as a vice presidential running mate to continue without any comment from me. Because Joe Biden's not going to listen to me, and so much of the speculation is just people who are promoting their favorite candidate. But what I find interesting is that I have resisted the identity politics. I felt that Biden made a mistake when he pledged to name a woman. And in recent weeks, African Americans have pressured him to name a woman of color as his running mate. And I'm not opposed to it. My issue is that many of the women of color who are proposed don't have a track record in national politics or in winning elections. And I very much want to see Donald Trump ousted in November, even though I'm no fan of Joe Biden's. And so to saddle him with an identity politics requirement, I think is a serious mistake. And a current poll shows that 4 in 5 registered voters said that race shouldn't be a factor in Biden's selection of a running mate. That group included 3/4 of the black voters polled, more than 8 in 10 white and Hispanic voters. About 1/5 of black voters say they would like to see Biden choose a black running mate. And the largest group with that preference is very liberal voters at 37%. So I find this encouraging. Because I think it's quite likely that Biden will fall in line with the identity politics demand. But to see that voters do not attach that significance, even African Americans, I think is really significant. And the Times has an interesting story today about the debate over whether the term black, when it refers to a person of color, an African American, should be capitalized. And I've noticed in recent weeks that in various publications, it has been capitalized, in other places not. The New York Times has not made a decision. The Associated Press has changed their style book to prefer capital B to a lowercase. Jesse Jackson is opposed to this. He said black is a color. And he's the one who promoted the term African American to refer to black Americans, to people formerly called Negroes. We built the country through the African slave trade. African American acknowledges that. Any term that emphasizes the color and not the heritage separates us from our heritage. And I think that's a legitimate point. And it's interesting, the New York Times quotes its own executive editor, African American Dean Baquet. It has been the subject of a lively and surprising debate. And his own newspaper doesn't mention that he is black, whether it's capitalized or not. They cite the history of W.E.B. Du Bois, who favored keeping the term Negro. He said, there are so many Negroes who are not Negroes, so many colored people who are not colored, so many Afro-Americans who are not Africans, that it's simply impossible to even coin a term that will precisely designate and connote all the people who are now included under any one of the terms mentioned. And speaking of vice presidential prospects, I don't support Kamala Harris as Joe Biden's pick. Now, she's a tough interrogator. She'd be a good debater. But her policies as Attorney General of California were not progressive. And when she was a presidential candidate, she tried to present it that way. But the question does arise, is Kamala Harris black? Is it fair to refer to her as African American? Because her heritage doesn't include any connection to Africa. And do you regard Jamaicans and people from India as black? Well, some Jamaicans are. But in general, even dark-skinned Indians are not called black. And so I don't have a solution. And I can leave it up to Senator Harris to designate the term that she prefers. But it is an interesting question. And finally today, I want to recommend for your weekend reading a lengthy second installment in the Gray Zone's investigation into efforts in Mexico, which are not very secret or covert, to take out its president prematurely. Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador, better known as AMLO, is the subject of a concerted effort by the right-wing National Action Party and the neoliberal Institutional Revolutionary Party. And they publicly state that they want to remove him from office by this November, even though his term runs through 2024. And the group has aligned itself with elitists. They call the AMLO government a communist dictatorship. And I think there are some failings of AMLO, like submitting to Trump's demand to hold migrants in Mexico and prevent them from coming to the United States. But there's a group called FRENA, F-R-E-N-A, that calls itself the National Anti-AMLO Front. They have asked the Trump administration for support to stop the agenda of AMLO and to earn the support of Mexicans who agree that the Bolivarian dictator Andre Lopez must resign. So I am opposed to this. Nobody asked my opinion, but I do not support, and the U.S. should not in any way collude with people who want to take down the duly elected leader of Mexico before his term expires. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. Have a good weekend. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.